Thank you so much for having me, Linda. I really appreciate your inviting me. And Linda's gonna, while I'm presenting, Linda's going to pass around petitions calling for a constitutional amendment. And if you want to kind of stay in touch with us and continue the dialogue, make sure you sign that petition so we can follow up with you, and also so you can show your support. It's in your clip. So I just want to start with some important knowledge, some kind of important background. So those are people. That's important that you know from my presentation if you're going to get it. So these are people. These are not people. This is an important foundational thing. So if you don't have that, you might have some trouble later on. I have no financial relationships to disclose except that people are funding our campaign. So. Not the second. So I'm going to talk about Citizens United, the ruling and its implications. I'm going to talk about how this specifically impacts tobacco, drug, and food industry and their growing influence. Talk about some solutions, specifically talk about the campaign for a constitutional amendment and how you can get involved with that. So the ruling, which happened January 21st, 2010, it was based on two foundations. It was based on Buckley v. Vallejo, which said that money is speech. It said that campaign spending is a constitutionally protected form of speech. And Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific, which said that corporations are essentially people, that corporations have the same constitutional rights that people have. So because of that, the court said that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money to influence our elections. The court did this without the direction that the court's supposed to take. The court is supposed to only rule on a case or controversy before it. And the court didn't do that. It said to the parties who were talking about a very narrow issue of whether a documentary attacking Hillary Clinton could air a certain time before the elections, whether they had to disclose their donors. The court, if it's a constitutional issue, the court's only supposed to, it's not supposed to rule on a constitutional issue unless it can't rule on the narrow issue before it. It could have ruled on that narrow issue. The court also has to rule based on the facts that it's gleaned from the lower court rulings. So the court didn't do that. It had a political agenda in mind, and the five justices who ruled on Citizens United had a political agenda in mind. So it sent back the case to the parties and said, we want to talk about these broad constitutional issues. That's what we want to rule on. And what the court decided, and if you read Brennan's dissent, he's outraged at this, and Roberts actually wanted to make sure that Souter didn't write the dissent because he would have exposed a lot more of how the court violated its basic principles in making this ruling. But the court said that independent expenditures of corporations don't give rise to corruption or even the appearance of corruption of our political process. So any of us here could say very easily that a corporation giving millions of dollars to a candidate or to an independent expenditure that's supporting that candidate is going to have vast impact on what that candidate does. But the court didn't have lower rulings. There weren't facts that were presented to the court to address this issue. So basically the five justices could say, we don't think it does, so we're going to rule that it doesn't. So what happened because of Citizens United? So there are two entities now that give to our elections separate from PACs, which give directly to candidates. There are super PACs and there are 501c4s. So, and through 501c4s, corporations can give without disclosing who's giving. So a lot of our money coming into our election process right now, we have no idea where it's coming from or how much money these individual entities are giving to the 501c4s. So super PACs, you don't give directly to the candidate. So they're quote-unquote independent expenditures. And they can come from unions, they can come from corporations, or from individuals. And Speech Now, which followed quickly after Citizens United, said that not only can corporations give unlimited amount, but individuals like Adelson or Bloomberg can give unlimited amounts to these super PACs to influence the elections. So what happened? So here's a graph of the total outside spending that ends in 2012, and already 2014 is ramping up to be as high or higher than this. so that you can see how the how outside spending has changed in our elections since the ruling. Over $6 billion was spent on the federal elections in 2012. So the scope of how much money is being spent, and if we think about how much money each of us can contribute to a candidate, we realize how far away our democracy is getting from us and our individual influence. And this statistic is really astounding. There were 61 large donors, whether they're institutions or individuals, who gave an average of $4.7 million. They matched what 1.4 million of us who gave to the presidential candidates gave in the elections. So these 61 individuals controlled the spending that 1.4 million of us gave to the presidential candidates. And that's what's happened as a result of Citizens United. And it matters. This money matters. 84% of House candidates and 67% of Senate candidates who outspent their opponents won. So you know that if you're in office, either you have to capitulate to these large donors or you're not going to be there. So you can be a really principled person, but you're not going to be a principled person who's reelected. Last month, the Supreme Court heard arguments in McCutcheon, which would now allow direct contributions to candidates up to $3 million. So no longer even this pretense that it has to be individual contributions. If the court rules the way it seems like it might in McCutcheon, individuals could give up to $3 million direct contributions to candidates. So I don't have $3 million to give. I'm not sure many of us in here do. But the individuals who do, these small group of donors, are having an increasing power over the political process in Washington. And many people have outlined, including the New York Times, how these small group of donors really affected the government shutdown and planned the government shutdown, just as one example. So what does this mean? What happens as a result of these things? Well, the tobacco industry contributed nearly $54 million just to state-level candidates, political parties, and ballot initiatives, $47.2 million to defeat just two ballot measures that would have raised taxes on tobacco. So that's an amount of money that we, as individuals who care about these issues, can't compete with. Agribusiness contributed nearly $92 million, that was disclosed, to federal candidates. $20 million to Democrats, $60 million to Republicans. Monsanto, separately from that $92 million, just Monsanto spent $8 million to defeat an initiative in California that would simply label whether or not a food was genetically modified. $8 million. The beer, wine, and liquor industry spent $18 million disclosed in the federal elections. So I keep saying disclosed. Well, what does that mean? This is a graph of what disclosure looks like. And you can see that it's going down to around 50% of the money from outside spending that's disclosed. So what's not disclosed? Well, by accident, Aetna filled out a form wrong, the insurance company. So we got to find out Aetna's givings. No other corporation has done this except for Chevron, who decided they wanted to disclose their givings. But by accident, they disclosed that they've given $7 million, $4 million to the Chamber of Commerce, and $3 million to the extreme right-wing American Action Network. So that they, by mistake, they filled out a form wrong, and we got to find out. But we don't know where all these other corporations are giving. And there's a slide missing here, but just recently we found out that $250 million was spent by one of these 501c4s in 2012 that from undisclosed sources that was operated by the Koch brothers. So $250 million that we don't know where that's coming from. So not only was the ruling important because corporate personhood enabled corporations to give directly to influence our elections, but the issue of corporate personhood, that corporations have the same constitutional rights as individuals, is very important in the area that we're talking about for commercial speech. So the tobacco industry frequently uses the idea of corporate personhood and commercial speech to defend its quote-unquote right to advertise or its right to silence, to not put disclosures or warning labels of certain sizes or certain prominence on its packaging. For example, in Massachusetts, the tobacco industry fought regulations preventing advertising in front of schools using this idea of commercial speech. The agribusiness uses its quote-unquote right to silence in challenging laws that force disclosure on genetically modified products. And those are just some examples of how corporate personhood works beyond just the issues of corporate giving and election. Oh, there's the slide, sorry. There's the slide. So on a quarter of $1 million that was just disclosed. Or sorry, a quarter of $1 billion, $250 million. So the Citizens United ruling, things were bad before Citizens United happened. And the influence of just the industries we're talking about here was tremendous in the political process before Citizens United. But what Citizens United did is it made it clear to us how bad things were getting. And it really, and this is a picture of Dred Scott. And Dred Scott, I don't want to compare Citizens United to Dred Scott. Dred Scott was the ruling that led to the Civil War and maintained slavery by the Supreme Court. And I don't think we can quite compare the scope of Citizens United to it. But what we can see is that Citizens United, like Dred Scott, was a call to action to people, that things have gotten too bad and that we need to make a change. So what's in store for the future? Do we accept this? Do we accept this massive buying of our political process and undermining of our agenda as civil society? Or do we take action? So what we're doing is we believe it's essential that we all take action. And I'm not saying that any of you should go back and stop working on the issues that you're working on. But what I am saying is that everyone who's involved with civil society, whether you're working on environmental issues or labor issues or civil rights issues or health issues, that our second issue or your second issue should be campaign finance reform, should be building a stronger democracy, because if all of us work on these issues, then we can start to turn the tide. And it's absolutely essential for us to make any of the individual changes, whether it's climate change or labor laws or healthcare reform, any of the work that we're doing, if we're going to be successful, we have to take on this massive influence of industry on our government and the wealthy on our government. So some of the things that are happening for pro-democracy reforms, people are working for voting rights. We have a slogan, money out, voters in. And we believe that those are the same two sides of the same coin, that the attack on voting rights and the buying of our elections are interrelated and have to be talked about together. Working for public financing to change, for example, in New York City, where they have public financing, where they have small donor matching funds, it changes the dynamic of who's elected, how they campaign. So in the same district where people are running for state assembly and city council in New York City, the state assembly candidates who don't have matching funds, they get their money from a small group of white wealthy donors. The people who are running for city council, where they get 7-to-1 matching funds for any small contribution up to $150 to their campaign, they get their money from everyone across the board. It's multiracial. It comes from low-income people. And when they go out and campaign, they campaign in people's backyards. They do town halls. They interact with people. And it changes the way they advocate for policy because of who they're interacting with and who they're accountable to. We need to advocate for disclosure just so we know where this money is coming from. And we could actually say, well, if Philip Morris is giving $200 million to this candidate or to this super PAC, we need to know that. We need to be able to say, well, that's why this candidate or this party is not advocating for tobacco regulation. Shareholders should have a right to say whether or not their money and their corporation is contributing to elections. But finally, only a constitutional amendment will prevent this massive flood of money coming into our elections, a constitutional amendment or another Supreme Court ruling. So there's a growing national movement. There's cause for hope, and I really encourage each of you to be involved, to make sure you sign the petition, to get active. Also, if you sign the petition, you'll get a correct version of my handout, which was by accident copied the same thing on each side. So another bonus of signing the petition. So signing it is the first step of getting involved, because you'll find out and be able to stay in touch with what's happening. There are nearly 500, or probably now it's, we're just about to go over 500 local municipalities that have called for a constitutional amendment. There are 16 states and Washington, D.C. That have called for a constitutional amendment. Right now, some of the target states that we're working to add to that list are New Hampshire, where I was just meeting with some folks there and is doing incredible organizing, in Arkansas, Iowa, New York, Missouri, and a few other states. Texas is doing great organizing, are working to become the next states to call for an amendment. To get an amendment, we need two-thirds of Congress and three-fourths of the states, so we need 38 states. So we're a ways away, but we're building a movement, and we believe that building the movement, whether or not we win an amendment, is essential. The Equal Rights Amendment movement is an example of an unsuccessful movement for a constitutional amendment, but a movement that really changed the dialogue in our nation. And we think whether or not we win this movement for a constitutional amendment, the fact that there are people out there on the streets holding rallies, having meetings in their living rooms, doing petition signings, getting their city councils to pass resolutions, that all of those things are building a movement that's changing the dialogue, that's saying that corporations shouldn't have constitutional rights, that money, that campaign spending is not a protected form of speech. It's a way of amplifying speech, but it's not speech itself. That these are things that need to change. And whether it's through a constitutional amendment or through another Supreme Court ruling, our movement will make those changes. So over 135 members of Congress have called for an amendment. We just went over 30 members of the U.S. Senate, which is an exciting milestone. President Barack Obama has called for an amendment. Over 2 million people have submitted petition signatures, like the one that you're signing today. Over 140 national organizations under the umbrella of United for the People, the website's United for with the number for the people.org, are united around this work. And when people are polled and when people vote on this issue, when it goes before a polling place, a huge majority of people support a constitutional amendment, no matter what party they're in. And this really can be seen when it's put to a vote. Like the state of Colorado and the state of Montana both had it on their ballot last year, and both of them voted with 75% margins to support a constitutional amendment. Every single time it's been put before a city that I'm aware of, it's passed with about a 75% margin. Those include really conservative small suburbs. They can include cities like San Francisco and Chicago and Los Angeles. Actually, some of those had around 80%. There's a huge demand for this, and people agree on this. And there's not a lot of issues that people agree on with this breadth in the United States, but we need to turn this massive agreement to policy. We need to turn it into change. So I encourage you to get involved. There are organizations all over the country that are working to make this change. Our website is democracyisforpeople.org. My card is up back. I really hope, and if you sign the petition, you'll start getting emails from us, so you'll hear what we're doing. There are other organizations, many other organizations that are working on this, that are building chapters, that are organizing for state resolutions. So you can go out and collect petition signatures. You can use that petition and go and take it out, and that's on our website. So you can print it. You can start a group. You can write a letter to the editor. You can meet with your congressperson. You can get involved or start an effort to pass a local or state resolutions, and resolutionsweek.org has a map of all the resolutions that have passed. You can work with students who you have relationships with. We're just working now with a coalition to build Students United for Democracy, which is a really exciting effort, and we think that a student movement is essential to moving this forward. So we're working with students around the country to get them involved to pass campus resolutions and to get them involved with bigger efforts. So I hope you'll be in touch with me. I hope you'll be involved with this work, and I'm really grateful for Linda for having me here today. So thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Well, that was exciting. Guess we have our work cut out for us when we look at, I do a pretty good job of trying to make some donations to some of my local people running for office, but I can't compare with some of the numbers that we just looked at. So with that, I'd like to like to open it up for some comments and questions for the presenters. What Jonah did refer to is that there's a petition that they have, and I started 4 copies of that around the room for those who are interested, 2 at the back moving forward and 2 at the front moving back. So just make sure we get those back. Also, if you're interested, there's another copy up here after we're done with the Q&A for the session. So is there a question or? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, okay, just a second. I recognize somebody first, and then we'll come to you. Certainly, thank you, sir. Go ahead. Sorry.
I
want to
presume your topic is legal services. Some are pushing across alcohol, tobacco, food, and pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just hearing about pharmaceuticals today.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Yes, the topic.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit in the first presentation and some of the comments of trying to look at those substances in the convening that was held at Alcohol Policy 16, and that was one of the topics that was a little bit difficult to fit into some of the same challenges that we have with alcohol control efforts or tobacco control efforts or food policy efforts. But there certainly are issues where we've got people working on things like prescription drug takebacks in communities and trying to address those things. And Alameda County in California has just passed an ordinance that requires pharmaceutical companies, for instance, to pick up the cost of disposing of unused medications, which is a huge environmental impact issue. And so being able to, that ordinance is getting challenged in the courts now, for example. So again, that challenge of how we get pushed back. So we didn't have as much specific to pharmaceutical issues as we had hoped for initially when the session got titled last March, unfortunately. So. I'm not going to get too far off track about going into explanations about the different issues since a lot of that is presented, but one of the big problems that we have in substance use prevention is that unused medications are used then by young people to get high or for other purposes, and because they're not disposed of properly, they can cause problems like if you flush them down the toilet, they get into the water system. So we've got a lot of unintended consequences from things like unused drugs and not a proper way to dispose of them. And so that's what's meant by that. I don't want to get too far off track and go into that one specific area, but that's so. Yeah. So thank you. So, yes. Okay.
It will provide good, healthy food. But APHA, as you may have noticed, does not do that and get after
it. Well, that's excellent feedback. So thank you. So, yes. Thank you. Exactly. Good points, good points. Yes. Yes. And Jonah, maybe you'd want to.
Just a little off topic of what I was presenting, but on the issue of infant formula, Public Citizen also has a campaign on infant formula, and we're working to make it so that hospitals don't send home free infant formula in the hospital bags as a campaign that we're involved with. And I think there's a real opportunity with the movement for a constitutional amendment. And of course, the pharmaceutical industry is a major contributor and one of the most intricately part of the U.S. government in trying to control the way it makes policy. So, I think there's a real opportunity now to push back on corporate power, that they have started to go too far, and it's a chance for people to unite across causes to make that part of our message.
Well, I think we're raising some really good points here about how deep and how far-reaching the impact of resources and money and corporate messaging go. And so while we focused, you know, on three big broad areas mostly in the conversation and the presentations, we're quickly identifying more areas where this is applicable, which is the potential also to bring in more allies, whether it's other sections in APHA or other allies in our community to start looking at this. So you had a comment or a question. As far as across different substance areas, different product areas, I think that's part of it is that there is so much in the siloing. Occasionally you'll see small-scale efforts where, like, you're doing both tobacco and alcohol compliance checks, and a law enforcement agency or a local government has sponsored that, so they're dealing with both. Cynthia, Norman, Jonah, examples that really look at, like, no corporate influence on our decision-making or no corporate control of the message in our schools or, I mean, because it is far-reaching on so many areas. I mean, I think that's, you know, some of the call for, you know, gets to, you know, what are some of our next steps? I mean, we don't have those kind of models really yet. And you know, where do we take, you know, this is, you know, kind of the seeds of starting some of this discussion. But Cynthia. Thinking about offerings that we have here at APHA and thinking about, you know, a month from now, the call for abstracts will open for next year's conference. So it's never too soon to plan, literally. But one of the things that I'm wondering is both from a section perspective of policy initiatives we can try to work on and promote within APHA, but also more information that we can try to recruit people to participate and present at future sessions, or maybe it's something creative that isn't necessarily a, you know, in kind of the standard format like this. Maybe we try to have convene some kind of conversation next year, or but I mean, are there ideas for things that would be good to try and have leadership from the section work on, like bring Jonah back again next year with a longer session in a plenary, or but yeah.
Thanks. I think one thing that seems to be cross-cutting, and it doesn't answer your question, but is that all three groups have what's called social aspects organizations. You know, there's tobacco groups that try to prevent a, quote, pseudo-public face. There's definitely alcohol groups, alcohol-funded groups that present, you know, quote, you know, sort of a public health, quotes, image. And I think in the food industry is that, too. And I think it'd be very useful to have a session to talk about the tactics that are used, what are the groups, you know, how do they use pseudoscience, what are their priorities, and how do they contrast with public health goals, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
My question is, have there been any attempts to maybe mimic some of the activities of the industry in terms of reaching and marketing the population? Because they're very, very good at marketing, and this was brought up in the presentation. You know, we just don't market, we show pictures of diseased lungs and things. So, you know, just in terms of in mimicking what the industry has done, that it, you know, just delivering the message better, you know, we can do that influence. It builds a population that actually we're asking to vote on these issues. Mm-hmm.
I don't know from tobacco. I know for alcohol, the only thing that really comes to mind is some of the social norms campaign, you know, trying to encourage, particularly like on college campuses, these were used for a few years, of trying to, you know, to point out, you know, like show young people having great fun not drinking alcohol and statistics of what percentage of young people actually don't drink on campus. You know, I'm not sure how well that strategy resonates with, you know, in competition to the fact that the stadium's named after a beer company, for example, on campus. So, but, you know, I don't think there's a lot that way, Cynthia, Norman, any?
It's tough in part, and I hate to, you know, say it's related to money, but, you know, we don't, in public health, have as much money. There's going to be a new tobacco campaign coming out. FDA is going to be, you know, targeting certain subgroups. I know it's rural and urban youth and some others, but I don't know how cutting heads are going to be. The Chew campaign back in the day, we made millions of dollars. We wanted to run that campaign, but now it's been cut back. So some of it is related to financing. Some of it may be related to not quite applying the same creativity. But there has been stuff out of tobacco. And again, and when things were well-funded, and alcohol prevention is no longer well-funded, and tobacco is losing money as well, we just don't have the same resources. But there are cheap or no-cost sources, and we need assistance and feedback from younger professionals about how to do this via online social media. Or that's how electronic cigarettes started to be advertised. So just using that as one example, how can we use those mediums to also do that?
And I think to add on to that, you know, a lot of the marketing that happens too is so targeted that, for instance, if you're talking to adults in a community coalition, they may not know that, you know, because the marketing is so slick. You get texts on your phone, you get stuff on the internet, but also the products change all the time, and there are new products developed all the time. So, like, for instance, I used to do just a handy little exercise where I'd go to the local liquor store when I went into town to do a training, and I would grab 8 or 10 different single-serving bottles of colorful-looking alcohol products, but two of those would be non-alcoholic products. And I would put them up in front of the room at some point during the training, and I'd say, okay, everybody identify which two of these do not have alcohol in them. The youth that were present at the training were always the only ones that got it right. And they knew these products, and they could also tell you which one, if it was a wine cooler that their mother or father drank, for example. So, you know, we're not always effective at figuring out what young people will hear, but, you know, we've done strategies like that at a legislative arena where legislators sometimes get a little surprised when they start to see some of these kiddie cocktails, we used to call them, but some of these things that are really, you know, like Jell-O shots with alcohol in them that were packaged and sold for a few years. And take those into legislators and then say, really, you're going to take money from the people who produce this in the community? So those are some lower cost ways we can do it, but it takes a lot of leg power and to compete with the amount of money that can go in. It's, you know, we've got our work cut out for us for sure.
That's
a great idea. That's a great idea. Yeah, exactly. Good idea. And, you know, suggestions also for other sections we should be reaching out to. I mean, we focused in on a few product areas, but, I mean, I think a lot of sections are dealing with similar things, so.
Okay. And so we are learning how to come together and share strategies. And so I would hope that a future presentation might include people from the behavioral health side, people with expertise in mental health and substance abuse, and come together with public health experts.
Okay, thank you. So. Can you speak up just a little bit? Or if you want to come up and use a microphone, you could even. So. Great. That's a great suggestion. We'll be hopefully you'll be presenting something on that next year for us. Great. Any questions specifically to what Jonah is working on? Since we, you know, the rest of us will be around the conference the next few days, and this is the only afternoon we have him.
The numbers for APHA. I know some institutions like unions, which used to be a little bit competitive with some of the corporations, are no longer because of this influx of money. So they're no longer kind of in the top of the contributors. It's all major corporations or like the Freedom Partners, the Koch brother thing that we just discovered gave $250 million. So those are I don't know APHA specifically. Sorry, but I'm sure it's not. It's not anywhere near, because I know the top 20 or 30, and it's nowhere near there. So,
yes. So have you done an analysis of the types of laws or bills that are being put out on the floor before and after these decisions are made? Do you know if, you know, whatever gets attention in Congress has been changed?
Well, I think the government shutdown is a really good example. Like, there was a great New York Times article kind of exposing how there was a group of extreme conservatives who got together with these major funders and plotted out the government shutdown and said they were going to launch this agenda. But I think there was a really interesting poll that came out that showed how the extreme wealthy have different values than most of Americans. So the extreme wealthy don't think there should be more taxation so that people could have health care, for example, compared to what the average American thinks. Or the extreme wealthy think that debt reduction is the most much more important issue than the average American. So when you think about the issues that are addressed in Washington, debt reduction all of a sudden becomes a bigger and bigger issue because of the influence of these small group of wealthy donors versus issues that as civil society we care about.
From casinos in casino towns or casino states as part tobacco money. Well, what about taking it from other corporations like casino interests or Nestle or whatever the case may be? And do you have sample resolutions that cities and or organizations could also adopt? I mean, we've at A&R put some together, but I think that we can have something a little bit better from
I mean, that's interesting. We haven't worked on, and that's not a specific frame that we've taken around the constitutional amendment campaign, but we could definitely work with you on something. As Public Citizen, we were really strict about not taking any corporate money or anything, any in-kind contributions. I think it's a good idea and something we could consider with you. At the same time, also, APHA hasn't taken a stance on a constitutional amendment, for example. And a lot of major health organizations haven't gotten involved at the same rate as like environmental groups. So I think I would really encourage people here who are part of national institutions, including the APHA, to put forward resolutions. And we do have sample resolutions of those to get your organization to be committed at least on board with the United for the People broad umbrella of groups working on this.
Not so much closing as just to support what Cynthia said, that there are some organizations, some cancer charities that I work with that have clear policies of who they will not take money from. In one case, they got some money from an alcohol company because there was a glitch in communication and they turned it back, and to their credit. And you can also see if you look at their websites, you know, how prominent some of the risk factors are and how in some cases how they're not, they're basically buried. So I think there's some movement there in the right direction. And the more organizations that have clear corporate policies about whom they'll take money from and whom they will not, it's very important.
Other questions come in. Time for another one or two. You're going to have to head out quite quickly, I think, right, because of the flight?
I can see a little bit.
Okay, so there's a moment or two, but cards are in the back. There are a couple of petitions working their way around it, and also copies up here. Just make sure we get those back so that you can get the information. Jonah, any closing remarks to leave with us?
Just to reemphasize, I think this has to be everyone's second issue, if it's not your first, that it has to be something that we're all involved with. It's a huge struggle. It's momentous, the power that's against us in this, but I think that there's a chance to change the tide and to win on this, and it has to be something that everyone is involved with in one way or another. So I would just encourage you to find out more, to look on our website, look on some of the other websites that we link to, and find out how you can get involved locally, and just stay active and communicate with people about this. Thank you again, Linda, for inviting me. It was really fun to be here.
Well, thank you for coming, and we want to make a public health advocate out of you. So we'll be your second issue if you'll be our second issue.
Of course.
I want to thank the panel, and I want to thank each of you in the room for bringing forward some good ideas and comments and questions and your attention. And we do want to look at what some of the next steps and strategies are. This was a little experimental as far as some of the dialogue and to move this forward a little bit. And so I thank you for your participation and engaging in this way. And hope it was something that you all found useful too. And we would like feedback on ideas for how we can take this conversation, you know, to the next level. What can we do to plant some of these seeds and do additional things in the future at future APHA conferences. It also sounds like there's some momentum to start some discussion within APHA about does it make sense for us to have a policy at a national level that looks at this issue and supports the amendment. Because let's face it, this is a huge part of what a lot of APHA's membership does, and it impacts us greatly. So thank you everyone very much, and enjoy the rest of the conference. There should still be a few ATOD section program guides in the back. If not, stop down at our booth in the All Things APHA section. We have a social hour business meeting tomorrow night at 6:30. Please feel free to stop by and join us. Free food, and I honestly, now I'm a little worried about the menu, but we'll be happy to take critiques if we didn't do a good job of making it healthy. I'm not sure. I wasn't on that committee, but we'll certainly take feedback. It's usually good. So thank you, everyone.